Accession number 7472, Real 1.
Colonel Noble, Real 1. How did you come to be a member of 4th Indian Division, Colonel Noble?
This goes back to the early days just before the outbreak of war in 1939, when my regiment, the Queen's Own Cavalry Highlanders, the 2nd Battalion, were serving in India in a rather gloomy place called Ahmednagar. We had only just arrived from Egypt, and on arrival there we were placed into a brigade, an Indian brigade consisting of ourselves as a British battalion and two other Indian battalions. Already on the outbreak of war, which appeared imminent in those days, to return to Egypt whence we'd come. So during our time in India, which was limited to 10 months, most of our leave was stopped, and we prepared as best we could in India to train for the sort of conditions which we knew something about, although the other two Indian battalions knew nothing, of course, of conditions in Egypt and the Western Desert. So, at the time, I was adjutant of the battalion, and at the end of July, we finally mobilized after several alarms and excursions, and we sailed from Bombay on the 1st of August, the first day of Prohibition in the presidency, and we of course had a terrific send-off, as all the thirsty British in Bombay came on board to get a drink. However, we sailed in convoy from Bombay, escorted by HMS Manchester, I think it was, across the Indian Ocean to Aden, and finally up to Suez, where we came ashore. Here we found ourselves repairing to initially the very same camp that we used to be training from outside Suez a year previously before we had left for India. So in those days, we, the second Cameron, as I call it, were the British battalion, as I said before, of this Indian brigade, the first to mobilize and leave India. It happens to be the 11th Indian Infantry Brigade, and is the first, shall we say, mobilized brigade of what eventually became the 4th Indian Division. Well, a good deal of changing of equipment, vehicles, and so on and so forth had to be done after our arrival. And after, I think, about a couple of months training down on the canal zone, we moved up to the area of Mina House outside Cairo in Kazira. Here, this, I think, was about November of 1939, we eventually started to train for desert warfare as such. And, of course, we all had a great deal to learn. It was here, in Mina, that the divisional headquarters, the 4th Indian Division, was formed. And latterly, again, I think early in 1940, the 2nd Brigade, the 5th Indian Brigade, arrived from India and was situated, or rather trained, in the area of Beni Yusuf, which was south of the Mina camp on the edge of the desert. So around about the early, shall we say, by Easter anyhow of 1940, the division had formed to the extent of divisional headquarters, gunners, sappers, and two Indian infantry brigades. The third was to come on a good deal later. So, a very brief picture of the early days and the start of the 4th Indian Division. As you can see, it was completely formed outside India. The only formation that came as a formation out of India was the 11th Brigade.
How did you come to go to East Africa?
Well, the 4th Indian, together with the 7th Armoured Div, had taken part in the Battle of Sidi Barani, in which we had thrown out the Graziani's Italian forces out of the desert. However, as a result of that remarkable battle, the Indian soldiers called it a very good exercise. It all went so completely to plan that we were in the division, we were completely surprised that we weren't required to follow up the fleeing Italians, but we were put down on the ground, our transport taken away and given to the Australians who were coming up behind us, and we were told that we were off to East Africa to help remove Musa's other armies who were at the moment, at that time, making faces at the Sudanese and Sudan. So it was, we eventually got back from the desert to the outskirts of Alexandria just before Christmas. All good Scotsmen, we enjoy our Hogmanay. We remember that one fairly well. Although there was not much, shall we say, of the right, the real Mackay about. Morale was extremely high, but there's a lot of work had to be done very quickly to get ourselves set. I think perhaps one memorable moment can be given that and be recorded here, that when the brigadier, our brigadier in the 11th Brigade, came to see us on later to be Lieutenant General Sir Reginald Savory, the last Adjutant General of the former Indian Army, came to see us on Hogmanay, and we walked round the lines with the Colonel and himself. He turned to the RSM and said, how are the jocks feeling and about going straight off to this new country? And the RSM replied, "Sir, and they bother, sir," or words to that effect, "if they have Colonel Anderson and a couple of infantry tanks, they'll go anywhere." This became almost a historical statement. However, from Alex, I'm not sure it wasn't actually on New Year's Day, or at least one day after, we took off by train back to Suez again, where we had of course, landed originally about 18 months before, and took off in the liner Reina del Pacifico, which was had been a luxury liner on the, I think, in the South American route. She'd been taken over for the war. However, she did have, apart from anything else, a unusually large complement of beer and other such drinks that we hadn't seen for at least the best part of 18 months. And we took off again in a small convoy. I think we had two nights on board only, and arrived at Port Sudan. Here we detrained, and the brigade moved off to by rail from Port Sudan to a place called Derudeb, D-E-R-U-D-E-B, which is on the Sudanese railway line that ran from Port Sudan, and in normal circumstances, through to Kassala and further south. We couldn't go much further than Derudeb without running into Italian opposition, as they had already occupied Kassala and thus broken the railway, so there was no through traffic, and it all had to stop short of Kassala. Well, here we detrained and camped. It's a pretty desert-like area with a few palm trees and so on. Nothing much to be said for it. But we sat there and gathered our bits and pieces together, waiting for what was to come next. This, I suppose, is probably around about the middle of January I'm talking of now. That's how we got to the Sudan. And when I'm talking of we here, it is the divisional headquarters and the 11th Indian Infantry Brigade. The 5th Indian Infantry Brigade, which I mentioned earlier, did not come down by sea. It came down the Nile Valley route, in other words, by railway and steamer down to Khartoum. Or Atbara, I'm not quite sure which. And so what had happened was that there we were, with divisional headquarters, with one brigade. Of course, there were other units in the area, notably units of the Sudan Defense Force, and also further south, units of the 5th Indian Division, who had appeared on the scenes, on the Middle East scenes by this time, had come straight into the Sudan via Port Sudan. They were further south of Kassala, in that area, and also facing the Italians, who were sitting on the borderline between Eritrea, Abyssinia, and the Sudan.
Could I ask you at this point about the reaction of you and your brother officers towards the necessity for a campaign in East Africa against the Italians? Why did you think that it was necessary?
Well, I think it was probably necessary in the long term for the clearance of the Red Sea and approaches to Egypt. I think at the time I'm talking of, we didn't go into the strategy behind all this in any great detail. Having successfully removed one lot of Italians, we're perfectly happy to have another go at this lot, who are obviously making a nuisance of themselves, and we reckoned that we'd remove them too. I think that was probably much more the attitude, and you're talking of the officers, the younger subalterns. I was a temporary captain or something at that stage. Incidentally, I should say about myself that after we'd got back at Christmas time from Sidi Barani, I was told that I was to leave the battalion as adjutant and to be taken on in the division as a general staff officer, grade 3. I protested, but was told I'd got to do what I was told. So, and I went down to Eritrea. I was no longer with the battalion. I was then with divisional headquarters.
Why did you protest?
Because I preferred to serve with the battalion, which I knew. Having been adjutant for 2 years or so, I'd taken part in all its build-up and everything. And, as I say, infantry soldiers prefer their own regiments rather than the staff. I believe probably always will.
Did you have any specific objection to being GSO3?
None, no. Not when I got there and I eventually found out. I learned a great deal, of course.
Can you tell me now what the duties of GSO3 involve and involved for you?
Well, perhaps it's a good thing just to explain what the staff consisted of. Would you like to hear the names?
Yes, please.
The GOC at the time was General Beresford Pierce, a British gunner, basically, who had served a lot of service in India, and he had been, in the early days in Egypt, he had been the commander of Royal Artillery, CRA. So he knew his way around the divisional personalities and so on. He had, of course, apart from his personal staff, on the general staff side, there was the GSO-1, who at this time in Eritrea was Lieutenant Colonel, as he then was, known to us all as Pete, Rees, R-E-S, who might be interested to hear, know that the present Treasury Chief, I think, in the present government is his son. He was a Rajputana rifle, a small man, but one with great charm, great ability, and great energy and drive, as was later to be shown when he commanded a division in Burma. The GSO-2 was an Indian cavalryman, a Major Henry Pickin, who had played a very big part in the organization and the early days training of the division in Egypt. He was the, shall we say, the staff officer who took the majority of the minor decisions once the overall plan had been approved and so on by the GSO-1 on behalf of the general. The GSO-3s, of which there were two, the one was the GS-3I intelligence, which is fairly clear what he had to do, and then the GSO-3, who really followed on after the GSO-2 and was assistant to him. Incidentally, the GSO-1 and GSO-2, of course, were both pre-war staff trained from the staff colleges. The junior ones had no staff training, and were learners, really, on the business of the staff work and how a divisional headquarters worked. So, of course, when operations were active, when one was on the move and so on, there were wireless sets which had to be manned. The communications with brigades, gunners, and so on, through wireless sets, were manned by officers, and although they each had a signaler to make sure the set worked, the staff officers actually manned it and took the information and passed the information, etc. This kept one busy while operations were moving pretty well all day and so on, and in the heat was extremely tiring, mentally tiring work. There were other smaller jobs one did, such as the control of the move of divisional headquarters. There's all sorts of small units attached to headquarters that one had to take control of when the whole of the headquarters was moving, and a variety of other smaller, less important jobs.
What were the main problems that you found in your role as GSO-3?
The main problems... you mean in action or in...
In all respects.
You mean what was difficult?
Yes.
After all these years, I find it a bit difficult to put one's finger on these things. You may think that because the division was a new one and so on, that there were a lot of problems connected with lack of kit, in different communications and things of that sort. But the spirit was such that one made as little as possible as one could of those and got things done in spite, whatever it was. We were a very, shall we say, in spite of only a few months together, the fact that we were taking part in a minor war and having success at it, one's morale was very high, and I can't honestly remember anything that was particularly difficult, other than something that the lack of kit and so on might have been made one's life rather more difficult.
Any specific items of kit that you're thinking of?
Well, here again, I think the unreliability, perhaps, our wireless communications in those days. Everything depended on the move, of course, on your wireless sets working. They were not, shall we say, part of a vehicle kit in the same way as they are today. And traveling over rough roads and the lot shook them up, and communication suffered very much as a result. Of course, apart from that, I suppose this was really the first war in which wireless sets were really used on a wide scale, that we still had to learn a great deal about them and how they were going to operate in different stages of the countryside that we were going through. And of course, we weren't aware of those sort of conditions. We did discover that they worked very much better on the whole at night or after dark than they did in daytime, which was, of course, very tiresome.
Can you remember what kind of range they might have had?
Well, yes, I would say in daytime probably something in the region of not more than probably 10 or 15 miles, if that. But at night, sometimes, on occasions, in Eritrea, one could even get communication back to Khartoum. But those are rather exceptional.
Now, I interrupted the narrative with you having arrived in the Sudan. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me how you got from that stage to coming into contact with the Italians?
Yeah. Well, there was a overall plan, as you can imagine, and it was planned that we should attack and seize Castle from the Italians around about early February of 1941. This would have given time for the 2nd Brigade, now 5 Indian Infantry Brigade, to have arrived down the Nile Valley route and have joined us. However, thanks to good work by the Sudan Defense Force units, who nipped in behind the Italian lines and smartened them up on various occasions and got them very jumpy, they eventually decided, or General Frusci, I think his name was, who the Italian commander, decided that he would withdraw. There was no further use hanging on out there. He'd further withdraw to rather more, shall we say, safer positions, defensive positions anyhow, within Eritrea. And in point of fact, they withdrew, I think I'm right in saying, the Italians withdrew round about the, well, let's keep it reasonably vague, well before, and in January, before we expected to make this attack. So when they withdrew, which I think was round about 19th or 20th of January, it was obvious that somebody got to follow them up and not allow them to stop. And so here we were with this our one brigade, the 11th Indian Infantry Brigade, and the of the 4th Indian Division, And in the south, the 5th Indian, Benares, with also one brigade available to follow up. Because there were two routes forward that we used. 4th used the north route, which was really only a dry weather track, and the 5th Division used the main strada, which was actually metalled, which ran from Tessenai south of weather track, the dry weather track I mentioned that the 4th Indian took. So our patrols discovered that the Italians had left, and we started to follow up. Now here I should explain that the very remarkable force, which was mainly composed of units of the 5th Indian Division and units of the Indian Cavalry. It was known as Gazelle Force. It was an ad hoc setup, commanded by a personality who was later also to become famous, Colonel Frank Musservey. This was the first time that he showed his true value, or had the opportunity to do so. But this force, which consisted of an Indian cavalry regiment, a battalion of Indian infantry, Sikhs, which were motorized, they were carried in vehicles, a field regiment, 25th Field, or a battery, I think it was, and other basic necessaries. But this force was, shall we say, its motive was, shall we say, bash on. And my God, it did bash. Whenever there was an opportunity, it simply drove furiously straight through and on to the next stopping place. And so they started off following the withdrawing Italians and Gassler down this dried weather track, and they met the first resistance and the like. Following it came the 11th Infantry Brigade, Indian Infantry Brigade, mainly on their feet. There wasn't enough transport to carry them, and the battalions were marching anything between 15 and 20 miles a day. It was hot work. In January, the weather was still hot. It was to get hotter still. We'd come from Egypt, where, of course, the winter in the desert up in the north there is very cold indeed. However, that is, shall we say, how we got started, and there, to tie it up, there are two lines of approach, of advance, following up the Italians, one in the north with the 4th Division manning it, and one in the south, 5th Indian Division working on that.
Were there any particular personal experiences of your own on that particular move into Eritrea?
Not in the early days, the early stages. Again, one was spending most of one's day sitting on a wireless set, recording messages and so on, and passing information around and the like. Of course, one heard one or two interesting items which perhaps should be recorded. Although I can't go into too many here, obviously, but this is one I think that attracted a lot of attention, rather latterly, more than at the time. The Gazelle Force got held up at a little hamlet, you can't call it much more than that, called Keru, K-E-R-U, where the Italians obviously reckoned it was to be their first, shall we say, defensive position. But Gazelle hadn't allowed them much time to get into position up there. But there was a string of hills across the route, and through the Stark Hills was a little core alleyway which they had, of course, filled with mines and the like. This is where the track ran through. So when the gazelle couldn't get on any further, then came the battalions on their feet, and they took to the hills to try and remove the Italians off it. Well, early one morning, the second morning after being there, the brigade headquarters, the Sudan Defense Force machine gun units, and others were all in place.